It is Friday, which means it's time for our week in review, beginning with a major state Senate push this week for policing reform. Activists like Rahsaan Hall of the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts say proposed legislation doesn't go far enough.
It does not actually capture the demands and the concerns of the people in the community who are most directly impacted by aggressive, violent, and racist policing.
The state Senate wants to pass the bill quickly, but Sutton Republican Ryan Fatman is pumping the brakes.
I think we have to continue to work on it.
There we go.
Work with our police departments. They want a seat at the table. The chiefs want a seat at the table. They deserve a seat on the table. They put their lives on the line every single day. We have to respect that.
Also this week, Phase 3, Step 1 began, allowing gyms, movie theaters, and museums to begin reopening. Here's ICA Director Jill Medvedev.
We are thrilled to reopen, to be part of the reawakening of our city. We do need the revenue. We've been closed now for 4 months.
All against the backdrop of COVID-19, spiking in 38 states, but seemingly leveling off here in Massachusetts. Here's Governor Baker encouraging visitors to the Bay State.
We have a lot of really great places to vacation, and I would encourage everybody and anybody to pursue them, and especially the folks from the states that surround us that don't have to rely on the 14-day quarantine.
It is all on the table, so call us. How would you like to see the state government reform policing? And as we enter Phase 3, how are you feeling about coronavirus and reopening? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So let's welcome our panelists. We have Marie St. Fleur, a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications and the CEO of a cannabis company. Marie, welcome back to the Week in Review.
Great to be with you, Tiziana.
Also with us is Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Good to have you back as well, Richard.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start in the state Senate, where we're having a conversation about policing. Lengthy debate was again postponed by Republican Senator Fatman today. He is the assistant minority leader. This is in the Massachusetts State Senate, where they want to, they've said, get a bill passed by the end of the month. First, what do you make of this particular bill, Marie?
Well, I think the times have brought our attention to it. I mean, the issue of bias in policing is one that has long been understood in communities of color. The fact that we're in Massachusetts, I have to say Boston, we do have one of the best forces, but that also recognizes that there are continuous ways that communities of color continue to be impacted and that we need to put processes and procedures in place to keep communities safe. My son should feel as safe as anybody else living in this city or in this state. But I know that for folks who look like me, that is not always the story. And so I am glad that this conversation is happening. I think it's timely. And I want everyone who is blocking to really put their feet in the shoes of the others, of other parts of this community who haven't had the same experiences as them, as positive as them, and understand that we as Americans deserve to feel free and as proud and as secure in our communities and in our state as everybody else.
So let's turn to you, Richard. Marie just sort of made a call to people who might be blocking the legislation. We heard concern from the top from State Senator Fatman that the process was being rushed. He again moved to table the bill today. So two questions. How typical is that for bills this close to the end of the session to come up quickly and then get delayed? That's the first question.
Well, what isn't typical is a bill of this magnitude not even having a public hearing. The legislature is an interesting body, and Marie can tell you they hardly ever do anything proactively. Everything is done reactively. And, you know, for the past 6 weeks, we've seen unprecedented protests around the country and here in the area. And this is a good opportunity to turn that energy into something positive. but the legislature usually moves very slowly and very deliberatively. And, in comparison with other things, this bill has moved at lightning speed. So I don't think you can really criticize, Senator Fatman for just wanting to slow things down for a couple of days to really look at what the bill does to give people a chance to weigh in that might not have had a chance because there wasn't a public hearing. There are 145 amendments, and Aaron, the people from, the Black and Latino Caucus Chair, Representative Gonzalez, has expressed concern that some of these amendments that are being offered, really could dilute the bill and, move attention away from the core of what the bill was, what they've been working on actually for a couple of years, and that is, the certification and decertification, establishment of that in Massachusetts, and, conduct-related standards establishing them for the bill. So, you want to move very carefully because at the end of the day, you want a bill that's going to work and not create more problems.
So let me just put the number up for our listeners, and then I want to come back to that and ask you both about it. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you want from your state legislature on this question of police reform? And what's the right pace to do it? Would you rather go into next year and have time for deliberation, or do you feel an urgency to do it now? So the two of you have talked about the yin and yang of public discussion and time to consider amendments, et cetera, versus as a word you use, Marie, which is this is timely. This is a moment we're in. It's something that people are pushing for. You're both former legislators. And I guess I find myself wondering, shouldn't there be a middle way where state government can be deliberative, but also be able to quickly process legislation and get it passed if the moment demands it and if people want it? How could we get there?
So I agree with Senator to say that very little that's innovative actually originates. It usually comes from the outside and moves its way in, and that the process is usually cumbersome. I guess that's what I'd say. But I would gather that if we took a little bit of time and did a little research, we could find instances where we've moved with deliberate speed, even when I was in the legislature. So there are instances where it's clear that we should move with deliberative speed. And I think this is one of those instances. We're finally having a conversation that has been happening in communities of color for generations, but has not penetrated the halls of justice or our legislature. And I think it's finally, there's a moment here that has really put it in pure relief. I think COVID has helped sort of unmask the disparities that exist. The death of Floyd has actually put it on every screen that we have. But we know that there are other thousands of microaggressions that happen with folks in communities across Massachusetts that have never borne light. And we want to be able to now use this moment because, if you delay justice, sometimes it's never arrives. And I think that's the fear for those who say, okay, let's just delay. We kind of interpret that as, well, let's just not let it, let's see if we can see if we could sort of delay it. Let's see if we can just get the attention off of it. And let's see if we just don't do this. And I think that's the concern. That's the concern. And it may not be what the intent is, but often that's what ends up happening.
Yeah, and if I could just chime in, I think that everybody wants to get this done. And I do think that you're going to end up seeing a bill come out of the Senate, and you're going to see one come out of the House, and it will probably be done before in the next couple of weeks. I think that what we're talking about right now is the bill coming to the floor a day or two ago, and senators having to really look at the bill and to look through the 145 amendments that have been filed that are pretty significant from a public policy standpoint, and try to make some judgments and try to really call in some experts, you know, I think that the police should have a seat at the table. You know, we need the police and we can't undermine their ability to do their jobs. They should at least have, you know, the chiefs should have a chance to weigh in. So I don't think that anybody's talking about, you know, postponing the bills for, you know, for weeks or months, but maybe, you know, a day or two or here on the weekend might not be bad, just to give people an opportunity to, you know, to see what's been done. And this
is, let's give our listeners
I'll just finish by saying this. You know, Governor Baker has been working on a lot of these issues with the Black and Latino caucus for about a year. So, you know, on certain things, you know, the whole idea of setting up a certification or decertification process to weed out, you know, bad eggs in Massachusetts, that's an idea that, you know, a lot of thought's gone into already. And I don't think that that's, you know, and there's any necessarily opposition to that. You know, there are a lot of these amendments.
So, Richard, as we start to dig into that, Richard, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I do want to actually start to give our listeners a little more clear picture of what's in the bill. So let's just take a break for a second. I'm going to play you some sound, Richard. You talked about the certification component, which we know was also in the governor's proposed legislation and has been in the works for a while. We spoke with Larry Ellison yesterday. He's an officer with the Boston Police Department. He's on the board of MAMLEO, which is the Massachusetts Association Minority Law Enforcement Officers. And he supports the idea of officer certification and decertification. Here he is.
As long as it's done fairly, as long as it's meted out equally, I am in total agreement with that. I think it's like anything else. You have a driver's license or any other license, you have to renew most licenses, and people want to reevaluate whether or not you're doing a good job. I don't see a problem with that.
And we heard from Wassan Hall. We had a cut from him at the top of the show, director of the Racial Justice Program for the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, talking about a sense of urgency around making sure that there's some teeth to anything in the legislation about qualified immunity.
Qualified immunity is a legal doctrine that protects police officers from civil liability for conduct that they are engaged in that is a violation of their rights. That legal doctrine has been expanded so much to the point that it is tantamount to absolute immunity.
So, Richard, I hear you on making sure that police chiefs and law enforcement have the ability to have input, et cetera. In listening, I find myself thinking, I ran a research center on nonprofit organizations back in the time of Sarbanes-Oxley, and there was a big push from nonprofits to say, don't pass legislation to legislate us. Let us do this. Let us have some more input. And the pushback was, there were years where you could have made reforms and you didn't. So now we're going to reform you. And I wonder what that tension is in this moment between years of calls for police reform, a moment where it could happen, and the desire to get more input. And I open this to both of you, Marie and Richard.
So I want to just say, I'm not against giving people, if we want to say, okay, let's take the weekend and go ahead and look at it. But I would submit that many of these issues have been being debated, even with the prior criminal justice bill that occurred a few years back. So there's been a lot of conversations about that. I agree that 145 amendments is significant for people to process. But during a budget, I've seen them process over 1,000. So I do think that there has to be an intent articulated that says that we want to move this. So I'll agree with Richard that, yes, give some people some time. And as it relates to the police have always had a seat at the table. And so we want to continue to encourage that. But I do think that there needs to be clear evidence that there's urgency and that that sense of urgency is communicated and that we don't go back into next week, because next week somebody else finds another reason to push it off and hopefully that it gets off the table. Because I am concerned about that, because that is unusual way.
Let's turn to the phones and then I'll give Richard a chance then to weigh back in. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Alexis on the line from Lowell. Alexis, what's on your mind?
Hi. So I just wanted to call in and talk about the importance of taking this opportunity to address a change that's really necessary, but also keeping in mind measured steps that need to be done for the legislature, primarily just by looking around and seeing what's already working. So my example is that in response to the shooting of Breonna Taylor, they banned no-knock warrants, of course, because the police were at the wrong address, when in fact in the state of New Jersey, warrants for no-knock entry or any entry need to be extremely, extremely detailed. So the color of the house is listed, the color of the shutters, the coordinates, the address, the front door color. It's very, 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 very detailed so that things like that don't happen. And that's been implemented, and it's already working.
Thanks for that call, Alexis. And Richard, let me turn to you, and I'll add a question onto Alexis's comment there. How much of that needs to be combed out in the legislation, and how much of that gets combed out in a regulatory way after the fact? So lots of things for you to react to there.
Yeah, that was a good point, because that, if I'm correct, when I looked over the bill, the no-knock, there isn't provision for that in the bill. That pretty much says, that it can only be done when there's reason to believe that the officer's life would be in danger. So there, it is being addressed. But I just point out that, you know, the bill, there are all kinds of different issues within the bill that, whether it's, a step from what the governor did, or whether it's in some of these amendments, but there's, amendment, a ban on facial recognition, there's provisions to get rid of tear gas or the use of dogs. There's so many different things. And you had mentioned qualified immunity, and just that issue in and of itself could be subject to a lot of debate, because, the other side would say, that making police officers subject to personal liability for split-second decisions, usually in very high-pressure situations, could result in life or death situations for the police. So, to make a change like that, there really should be a lot of discussion and thought put into it.
So Marie talked about earlier people being anxious, those who are really advocating for a police reform bill to be passed, being anxious that if the momentum goes away, this might sort of wind up in the dustbin of history. So let's just say for a minute that there is no final bill that gets passed before the end of July. What happens to maintain momentum into the future if that happens, Marie? How does one maintain momentum?
My sense, Tatiana, is that there's a energy and a sense of awareness that the public now has on these issues that I'm not sure they'll go away quietly. And so, and I do, in this time of COVID, you want to be able to make certain that we act as swiftly as possible. I think people are thinking that because so much is at stake, they still come out. If you saw the thousands of people that came out, understanding that they were putting their lives at risk, because they understand that this is such a unique moment in time. And so my guess is that there are elections coming up, that people have to keep the pressure on in their on their respective representatives. I do agree that it needs to be balanced. But I also think that there's been a silence period in the history of the Commonwealth where there's been expansion of particularly as it relates to qualified immunity. There's been an expansion that we need to sort of revisit that and figure out how where the balance is as it relates to the voices of citizens in this Commonwealth, as well as it is in terms of protecting the police. So I think one, they will continue. I think you'll continue to see advocacy going on. My concern is that advocacy also is happening in the light of COVID, and that creates another particular sort of challenge for citizens. And two, they've been asking for many years. This type of reform has been being begged for many years. So I think we can go back and take a look at the criminal justice the committees and see that public safety committees and see that some version of some of these bills have been on the has been attempted for many, many years. And so now there's an opportunity and we should take it.
Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK as we begin to talk about the coronavirus. Two categories of stories this week we're paying attention to. One, phase three, step one began this week. The next round of business is reopening. Let's talk about that. And then implications for schools. A number of stories about schools, universities, reopening in the fall, exams and testing during the time of coronavirus. So lots to talk about there. Give us a ring and join in. So Marie and Richard, let's just start with phase three, step one. The coronavirus cases are spiking in many states around the country. The country recorded its sixth single day record in 10 days with almost 600,000 cases on Thursday. But here in the Commonwealth, we have remained relatively flat. Seems like things are in where we want them. And so on Monday, we began to reopen indoor restaurants, movie theaters, museums, et cetera. So what do you think? Are we in the right place? Richard?
We're not in a bad place right now vis-a-vis some of the other states around the country. And you know, at some point, I think if you look at the whole trajectory in Massachusetts, things have been handled well. I would have loved to seen the governor be a little more aggressive as far as some of the reopenings and without as much government mandates, you know, telling, you know, for instance, for golf, they had 19, you know, it was sort of like they micromanaged the reopening. But overall, I think we're in good shape right now. And ultimately, you know, the bottom line is, you know, there's risk versus reward. You know, everybody just can't stop doing everything until a vaccine, you know, is discovered and hits the market and everybody's vaccinated. So we got to get along the best we can. And I think overall Massachusetts is in pretty good shape.
So, Marie, on Monday, we heard from Dr. Shira Durone, who's an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, on how she's feeling about the reopening. Here she is.
I'm feeling lucky to be a resident of Massachusetts right now. I feel like our governor and our government have really listened to the experts, have adhered to the plans that were set forth, and have really crushed that curve in every possible way. And so I think I'm excited that we are able to be in phase three.
Do you share that excitement, Marie? Have we crushed the curve and are we getting the guidance that we need? Sounds like we may have lost Marie there. So Richard.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
So there we go.
If you look at it overall, I think Massachusetts has done a tremendous job listening to the experts, right? And I think that given the abundant of wealth that we have as it relates to the medical establishment and our biotech world, that we've been able to take advantage of that. And the governor has made sound decisions. So when you look at it overall, absolutely. The economic impact is going to be significant for many, but particularly in communities of color. I think we were at a deficit to begin with. I think we're going to see even more of that take place. I want to commend our residents because they have actually understood that we are a commonwealth and how we behave, we impact each other. And so as I've looked around, I've seen people wearing their masks. I want to commend them for understanding that sometimes a little sacrifice, personal sacrifice, is good for the benefit of all. So I think those folks have been able to do that. And so I think all of that has made us in a better place. When you drill down, though, when you begin to drill down and disaggregate the data, then you begin to understand the disparate impact that this COVID has really outlined. Then you have to say, what are we going to do different, Massachusetts, as it relates to the public health of Black and brown people in this state? And in particularly in our cities. And so I think it calls for us to ask, what did we do differently that worked? And how do we adopt that and embed that in our systems so that we can continue to have healthy outcomes for people? I also want to think that we need to take a look at how we've treated not just Black and brown, but the elderly who are in some of our homes across the Commonwealth, and we've lost a significant number of elderly. And, you know, I come from multi-generational home, and we respect the elderly, and they are a gift. So that we've lost a significant number of people, we need to take a look at that and figure out what we do better, because this is not going away. And so, yes, overall, in the aggregate, absolutely. But when you go down and begin to really disaggregate the information, not all is equal.
So, Richard, to that point about not all being equal, the impacts of the coronavirus we know are disproportionately experienced by vulnerable populations and in our community and around the country by Black and Brown Americans. There's also concern that the long-term impact on ability to study, ability to participate in the economy, et cetera, will have unequal distribution. This week, an opportunity and achievement gap task force for the Boston Public Schools voted unanimously for a moratorium on an exam school admissions test. And then a couple of days later, Boston Superintendent of Schools Brenda Caselius announced a new contract for an admissions test and that there will be a new test in the fall. Is that a mistake on the part of the Boston Public School System, especially given the recommendation of the task force?
I'm not an expert on Boston, but I would say that, as far as public schools go, whether they're exam schools or, you know, wherever they are in the state, we should be doing everything we can to get kids back in school. And I think, you know, if you go by the science, which, you know, Massachusetts has done a pretty good job. The science is pretty clear that kids aren't affected by this, and you do have to make some adjustments, and there are challenges. But for the most part, I think having kids they've already had one school year disrupted, to have another school year disrupted, you know, you're going to have some major impacts that are long term. You know, if kids falling behind and just not doing well. I can't really criticize Boston for what they did, because if you don't give that exam, you know, how are they going to admit kids into the exam schools? You have to keep things going. And I think that they made the right decision.
So, Marie, one more question on that for you. Superintendent Brenda Caselius told the Boston Globe the test this fall will be fairer, untimed, strong anti-bias base. It's in line with state standards. Does that satisfy you?
Not particularly. Particularly since that I understand it that the Boston Public School Task Force was looking at that issue. And so the question that it raises for me, well, what is the purpose of citizens sitting and volunteering their time on a task force to give recommendations if before they're allowed to do that, a decision comes out? So that's a concern. It's a very sensitive issue, I think, in communities here in Boston, because as it relates to the Boston Latin School, where there's been a history of inequities. As it relates to access to that particular high school. So it does raise these questions. I also understand that she is behind in a rock and a hard place. She's between a rock and a hard place, trying to figure out how you move the agenda. I would take a step back and really listen to the task force who's been, you know, talking to citizens and getting a sense of what's going on. But also want to remind that, you know, Boston Latin didn't always have an exam. And that in the history of that exam coming up has actually heightened inequities in being able to access it. And if you are, depending upon where you fall in the economic spectrum, you've had better opportunity and chances to get in than a regular kid who may not have had that opportunity. So I am concerned. I think that given what's happened in Boston Public Schools right now, we know from some of the stories that not all kids were able to continue their education aggressively because of COVID. Not all kids have equal access to the technology in order to be able to engage in remote learning. So we already have a situation, the inequities are well documented in the Boston Public Schools. There's been a push to narrow those inequities. And the fact that it's a new exam yet to be tested, right? Where there's some assumptions being made about it. I think a timeout would not have been a bad idea, given the confluence of challenges. And then perhaps working with that task force to find out alternative ways to make certain that particularly Boston public school kids have equal, a real opportunity to get into Boston Latin. Because otherwise, I think that kids who are better positioned and may not have come from the Boston public school experience will be better positioned to now be able to get a seat in one of the most chosen schools.
Let's start talking about school reopening in general. It's become somewhat, it's starting to look like it's going to become politicized. And listeners, are you ready for your kids to go back? Do you want them in a school building this fall? What's the right balance between learning and safety? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here is President Trump on Tuesday at the White House talking about reopening America's schools in the fall.
We don't want people to make political statements or do it for political reasons. They think it's going to be good for them politically, so they keep the schools closed. No way. So we're very much going to put pressure on governors and everybody else to open the schools, to get them open. And it's very important. It's very important for our country. It's very important for the well-being of the student and the parents. So we're going to be putting a lot of pressure on open your schools in the fall.
Now, Governor Baker responded to the president's pressure, said he doesn't think a one-size-fits-all policy from Washington makes sense for schools. He said the federal approach is inappropriate.
I think what they ought to be doing is working with folks like us and others to come up with strategies that ensure that they and we can work together to ensure that schools have the resources they need to be able to open.
So, Richard, who makes the call, and how do we think about the tension between getting young people back in schools, making sure that we're not dealing with technology disparities, learning loss, et cetera, and maintaining safety, especially when different states are in different places on this coronavirus curve?
I think that what Trump should have done is said, I want all the schools closed, and then there would have been an uproar saying the schools have to open. Because whatever he was going to say would have triggered the other side, you know. But I think Governor Baker has it right, and that, you know, no one size that fits all. And Aaron, when you're looking at what's going on the state level, you know, the state has been pretty thoughtful about this, and they've gone to the local communities, you know, and told all the local communities to come up with three different scenarios sometime in August. You know, they'll make a decision as to which way they should go, depending upon what's happening on the ground, you know, that you could have traditional, you know, brick and mortar experience in the school. The second choice would be, you know, you could have remote teaching, as a lot of districts did towards the end of last year in the summer, or you could have a combination of both. So communities are, you know, putting together those plans right now. And there might be some areas of the state where there's, you know, a spike or, you know, an outbreak that you really don't want to go with option one, the brick and mortar. You know, so we want to be very flexible going into this. But ultimately, the goal should be to get the schools open, to get kids back to the school. You know, I remember Governor Patrick, when he was running for re-election, had a really effective commercial talking about education reform and how, you know, just 1 year in a kid's life, you know, academically, is huge. And, you know, just think about what's happening right now to all of the kids. And again, I feel comfortable saying that when you look at the science and you see that there haven't been, you know, there's no impact at all for school age kids as far as, you know, danger of them getting ill. There are subsidiary issues like, you know, teachers and autoimmune, you know, kids who have problems or teachers who have problems with that you have to identify. But the goal should be to try to get kids back in school.
So but we have to go to a break. But before we do, I want to go back to the phones and get a caller voice in here. 1-800-423-8255. We've got Seth on the line from Marblehead. Seth.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Quick question. I think it was alluded to right at the end was regarding teachers, whether they're in the process or in the later stage of teaching. So they are more prone, as well as teachers that are maybe expecting. So with expecting children or have, you know, pre-existing conditions, it's been really hard to hear about, you know, the kids. We want them to go back, but I think that it's not fair for anyone who's in the education service to risk their own personal safety just to get people in, right away.
All right, thanks for that call, Seth. And we're going to have to go to a break. I do want to note also, we're not clear about the risks for children in school age young people in terms of contracting the illness and the level of sickness. Still with us is former State Representative Marie St. Fleur and Richard Tessay, former Republican leader in the Massachusetts State Senate. You pull up a seat at the table. We are talking about schools coming back in the fall, higher education, and a new challenge to the models that colleges and universities plan to use from ICE this week. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I want to begin with a call. Let's go straight to the phones. We've got John on the line from Townsend. John, go ahead.
Hi. I guess the comment I was going to make is that I don't believe that the states or the local educational organizations have really been prepared to deliver remote and distance learning. Classes are pass-fail. They're not classes which are graded. And in some cases, I'm not sure teachers are really prepared to be able to deliver remote learning. I'll take your answer offline.
Thanks for that call. John, Richard, you had said in the last segment you had talked about sort of some discomfort around the level at which the state was or wasn't micromanaging details. This is one where we have great variation across school districts. We know this about the amount of interaction with teachers, the amount of FaceTime on Zoom, grading approaches, et cetera. What is possible and what should the vision be? Because we know 2/3 of the possibilities for the fall involve at least some, if not all, online learning for primary school. Do I have Richard?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, so I'm great.
Yeah, I think that, you know, remote learning or online learning is still something that we're learning an awful lot about, and it's going to take a while when studies are done on this to figure out exactly how effective or ineffective, you know, or what the right way to do it is, which is why, you know, every effort should be made to get kids back in the brick and mortar, school. Having said that, you know, Aaron, when you referenced micromanaging, you know, for some of the kids, it's not going to be a very good experience. And for the schools, it's going to be really difficult as well. I mean, that, you know, you have to be, originally they came out and said that kids had to be 6 feet apart. You know, they all had to be facing the same way. They all had to be wearing masks all day. There would be no gym classes, no lunch in the cafeteria. There are a lot of micromanaging going on. So, there's going to be a lot of, trial and error, and obstacles that are needed to overcome before kids are back in any way in a regular type of learning environment.
So, Marie, before we switch to universities, we've got a number of calls here. They're similar, so I'm just going to sort of paraphrase. Either teachers should go back because grocery store workers and other frontline workers are going back, or teachers need to be better protected if we're going to ask them to go back. So what is the appropriate state posture towards teachers as we think about reopening in the fall?
I think it's both, all of the above. We do know that while kids are have been ill less, right? But they actually carry it. And so we know that even though the kids, particularly kids between the age of 3 to 9, are less likely to get ill, they can carry it. And so you're going to put your teachers at risk. I do believe that that is some of that. Kids who are older may present differently. So we're going to put teachers in it. We're asking teachers to take the risk that, and then whether or not they're going to carry that out to their families, as as we've seen happen with some of our essential workers. We're also saying to kids, you know, now you're going to be in this bubble with other children. You might take it back to your parents. And so those are the risks. Those are the secondary risks that we're exposing people to. So we need to consider that. Two, most places don't have enough space to really do the distancing that everyone's talking about. So there are not enough seats in the buildings, seats in the town or in the city to really have the total student body come back. So at some point, we need to take a look at remote learning in a more direct way and think about how are we spending the next 2 or 3 months to train teachers to use this tool, which is called the computer, to be able to educate children, because a large percentage of them are going to do that. And I think the school department, Department of Education, has to be aggressively looking at that and providing some guidance to the districts. And as it relates to the federal government, they've left us alone all this time. I think they should keep leaving us alone because we figured out how to do it okay without their assistance thus far. So let's focus on what we need to do to make certain both our teachers and our children are safe. And at the end of the day, we need to be careful that we're not pushing kids back to school, one, because we need to be able to get people back to work. And so there's an economic angle to this and not simply the science as it relates to how ill people should get. So we need to focus on how we bring broadband to communities that don't have it, how we make how we make it accessible to people who can't afford it. And we need to be able to train our teachers as quickly as we can so that we don't leave significant percentage of children who will not have the benefit of a parent who can help them with some of the education that they need to receive at home, because we know, we don't have to guess, we know that that's how some of it is going to get delivered.
All right, we're almost time for hubbubs, but before we go there, I do want to get just a minute. Richard, I'll turn to you on this one, because ICE did declare at the beginning of this week that unless a student was able to change their status in some very specific ways, if a foreign student was attending a university that was offering all classes online, which several in the Commonwealth are, they wouldn't be able to be in the United States. At the risk of sounding oversimplified, how big a deal is this, and what's your reaction?
Well, the federal policy always has been that in order for when students come here, they have to be in in-person classes. And what ICE has actually done on two occasions during this pandemic is waive that rule. So this isn't anything new. This is a question of ICE pretty much saying, we're not going to waive it again. And if you think about it, you know, if these colleges are saying that it's too much of a risk to have college courses, you know, on campus, and that everything has to be done remotely, then it's probably too big of a risk for tens of thousands of kids to come from all over the world, you know, and potentially bring infections with them. If you're thinking along the same way for it to make sense, for them to come here just to take online courses that they could take at home. And the other thing I would say is ICE isn't saying...
Richard, let me just stop you there for a quick second, Richard. But if they're in a 12-hour time zone different with weak internet signal, can they take those same courses at home?
Well, I was going to say ICE isn't even saying that they can't come. They can come, but they have to go to a college that offers... in-person classes instead of online. And I understand about the time difference. I'm just saying, I think it's being portrayed a little differently than it is. This has been the policy for a number of years, and it's just a question of whether there'll be a waiver right now. And, you know, and I'll be honest, for a place like Harvard, all of those kids a lot of those kids are all cash students, you know, so it's very much a question of money. For those universities,
I'm sorry to stop you there, Richard, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry to stop you there. I do want to make time for a little bit of hubbubs because it's been a strenuous week and a little bit of niceness at the end would be fun. These are the brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Marie, 60 seconds or less, what do you have for a hubbub for us?
Star of the Sea, Kingston, Massachusetts. Thank you. thank you for bringing us closer together as humans. You launched your ship in 2019. It now in 2020, June 2020, it landed on the shores of Western Australia, and you brought the story of Kingston, Massachusetts to the world. So thank you.
Nice job, Star of the Sea. See, that lifts my spirits already, Marie. Thank you. And Richard, what do you have for us this week?
We talked about reopening, and just to give a plug to some of our museums and cultural institutions, New England Aquarium is reopening on July 16th. The Isabella Stewart Museum is July 15th. The Museum of Science is the 26th. Peabody Essex Museum up in Salem, if you haven't been there, you should really go. They're reopening on the 18th. The zoo has been reopened, and a lot of these places have really been hit hard by being closed because they depend upon people coming and tourists and so forth. So if you have a chance, you should go out and visit some.
Yeah, we actually had an opportunity to have an interesting conversation with the head of the Peabody Essex Museum earlier this week, really kind of going into depth about the steps they're taking to be prepared safely for reopening. It is a fascinating set of guidelines that museums have to put in place, especially those that might have interactive exhibits. So it's a good thing to think about. All right. So I just found myself reflecting. We had two doctors on the air on Monday taking COVID-19 calls. We did our first call-in on COVID-19 on March 9th. So we've been doing them for months, and our phones were still full the entire time. We hung up with full phones, which simply tells me that we are still in a time of great uncertainty about this virus, that while we have begun talking about other things, it is still weighing heavily on people's minds, and that over time there is a real hunger to be able to keep up with the speed of change and what we know, what's coming next, what the medical treatments are, etc. So I was just very struck by how front of mind this pandemic remains for our listeners, and I think for the greater population. All right. Thanks for the Week in Review this week. Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here. See,
and Marie St. Fleur, former Massachusetts State Representative, now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Marie, thanks to you too.
Great to be with all of you. Thank you.
And that is our show for today. We are a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Have a good weekend, but then join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.